One needs no evidence to condemn the Soviet Union for aggression in Afghanistan and for support of repression in Poland. It's quite a different matter when one turns to U.S. aggression in Indochina or its efforts to prevent the political settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict over many years. All of this is readily documented, but it's unwelcome and therefore a non-fact. No argument is demanded for a condemnation of Iran or Libya for state-supported terrorism. Discussion of the prominent, arguably the dominant role of the United States and its clients in organizing and conducting this plague of the modern era, that elicits only horror and contempt, and evidence, however compelling, is dismissed as irrelevant. As a matter of course, the media and the intellectual journals either praise the United States for dedicating itself to the struggle for democracy in Nicaragua, or they criticize it for the means it has employed to pursue this laudable objective. A challenge to the underlying patriotic assumption is virtually unthinkable within the mainstream, and if such a challenge were permitted expression, it would be dismissed as a variety of ideological fanaticism and absurdity, even if it were backed by overwhelming evidence. Not a very difficult task in this case. Case by case, we find that conformity is the easy way. It's a path to privilege and prestige. Dissidence carries personal costs. These costs may be severe, even in a society that lacks such means of control as death squads, psychiatric prisons, or extermination camps. The very structure of the media is designed to induce conformity to established doctrine. In a 3-minute stretch between commercials, or in 700 words, it's impossible to present unfamiliar thoughts or surprising conclusions with the argument and the evidence that's needed to give them some credibility.
On Ideas, you're listening to the 1988 Massey Lectures by Noam Chomsky. Chapter 2, A Propaganda Model of the Media.
It's a natural expectation that the major media will reflect the perspectives and the interests of established power. These expectations, in fact, are amply fulfilled. That has been argued by a number of analysts. My co-author Edward Herman and I have published extensive documentation in joint work and separately to support a conception of how the media function that differs quite sharply from the standard version, what we call a propaganda model of the media. According to this propaganda model, the media serve the interests of state and corporate power, which are closely interlinked. The media frame their reporting and analysis in a manner that supports established privilege and that limits debate and discussion accordingly. To subject the model to a fair test, we've selected examples that are as closely paired as history allows. Crimes attributable to official enemies versus those for which we and our clients bear responsibility. Good deeds, for example, elections, conducted by official enemies versus those in U.S. client states. There are by now literally thousands of pages of documentation supporting the conclusions of the propaganda model. By the standards of the social sciences, it's very well confirmed. If there is a serious challenge to this conclusion, I'm unaware of it. The highly regarded Freedom House study that I mentioned before, which is held to have demonstrated the adversarial character of the media, that study collapses upon analysis. It contains innumerable errors and misrepresentations, even falsification of its own documentation. And when all of this is corrected, little remains beyond a complaint that the media were too pessimistic in their pursuit of a righteous cause. I know of no other studies that fare any better. So to summarize, we have two models of the media. There's a sort of standard model, which is that the media are adversarial, cantankerous, obstreperous, that they confront state and private power, and then there's a debate over whether they do this too excessively. That's the standard model. According to the propaganda model, very much the opposite is true. The media are docile, submissive, and they serve the interests of state and corporate power. Those are the two models. And as I've suggested, the propaganda model has very extensive documentation to back it. I'll be giving some examples as I proceed. Now, there are, to be sure, other factors that influence the performance of social institutions as complex as the media. And one can find exceptions to the predictions of the propaganda model. Nevertheless, the propaganda model, I believe, has been shown to provide a very good first approximation, which captures essential properties of the media, and in fact, essential properties of the dominant intellectual culture more generally. Journalists often meet a high standard of professionalism in their work. They exhibit courage, integrity, and enterprise, and this includes many of those who report for media that adhere closely to the predictions of the propaganda model. There's no contradiction here. What is at issue is not the honesty of the opinions expressed or the integrity of those who seek the facts. Rather, what is at issue is the choice of topics, the range of opinion permitted expression, the unquestioned premises, and the general framework that's imposed for the presentation of a certain view of the world. Now, I will give a number of examples to illustrate the workings of the propaganda model, but in these lectures I want to rely on the ample material that's in print to establish the basic case. This work has elicited much outrage, vituperation, and falsification, but to my knowledge there is no serious effort to respond to the critique. Rather, such critiques are simply dismissed. Notice again that this is in conformity to the predictions of the propaganda model. Typically, debate over media performance within the mainstream includes critics of the adversarial stance of the media and responses by people who defend the media. But such debate excludes any critique of the media for adhering to the predictions of the propaganda model. It even excludes any recognition that this might be a conceivable position. The media do cheerfully publish condemnations of their, quote, breathtaking lack of balance, or even the appearance of fair-mindedness, and the ills and dangers of today's wayward press. Charges of this nature are often not unwelcome by the media. The first reason is that response is simple or even superfluous, and the second reason is that debate over this issue helps entrench the belief that the media are either independent and objective, with high standards of professional integrity and openness to all reasonable views, or, alternatively, that they're biased towards stylishly leftish flouting of authority. Either conclusion is quite acceptable to established power and privilege. Even the media elites themselves are not averse to the charge that they may have gone too far in pursuing their cantankerous and obstreperous ways in defiance of orthodoxy and power. The spectrum of discussion reflects exactly what a propaganda model would predict: condemnation of liberal bias and defense against this charge, but no recognition of the possibility that liberal bias might simply be an expression of one variant of the narrow state corporate ideology, as quite demonstrably it is. Let me return to the proposals of the Brazilian bishops concerning democratization of the media. One reason why they would appear superfluous or wrong-headed if raised in our political context is that the media are assumed to be dedicated to service to the public good, possibly even too extreme in their independence of authority. The assumption, then, is that the media are performing their proper social role, a role that was explained by Supreme Court Justice Powell. Powell stated, "No individual can obtain for himself the information needed for the intelligent discharge of his political responsibilities. By enabling the public to assert meaningful control over the political process, the press performs a crucial function in affecting the societal purpose of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees freedom of press." There's an alternative conception, which I believe is valid, and that is that the media are indeed serving a societal purpose, but quite a different one. They are serving the purpose that is also served by state education, as conceived by James Mill in the early days of the establishment of this system. That is, to, quote, train the minds of the people to a virtuous attachment to their government and, more generally, to the arrangements of the social, economic, and political order. Far from contributing to a crisis of democracy of a sort that's feared by the liberal establishment, the media are vigilant guardians protecting privilege from the threat of public understanding and participation.
The 1988 CBC Massey Lectures continue on ideas. Presented by Noam Chomsky. Chapter 3, Democracy and the Engineering of Consent.
Our political culture has a different conception of democracy from that of the Brazilian bishops. For the Brazilian bishops, democracy means that citizens should have the opportunity to inform themselves, to take part in inquiry and discussion and policy formation, and to advance their programs through political action. For us, democracy is much more narrowly conceived. The citizen is a consumer, an observer, not a participant. The public has the right to ratify policies that originate elsewhere, but if these limits are exceeded, we have not democracy, but a crisis of democracy that must somehow be resolved. This concept is based on doctrines that were laid down by the founding fathers of American democracy. Historian Joyce Appleby observes that, I'm quoting her, that the Federalists hoped that the new American political institutions would continue to function within the old assumptions about a politically active elite and a deferential, compliant electorate. The Federalist conception prevailed despite their electoral defeat. It was expressed lucidly by John Jay, the president of the Continental Congress and the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Jay said, "The people who own the country ought to govern it." By the people, constitutional historian Richard Morris observes, he meant a small nationalist elite whom he was too cautious to name. That elite consisted of the white-propertied males for whom the constitutional order was established. The vast exodus of loyalists and blacks to Canada and elsewhere reflected in part their insight into these realities. Jay and his associates were convinced that, as they put it, the people are well prepared for the government to assume that power without which government is but a name, and such few as are of a different opinion may easily be convinced of their mistake by that powerful argument, the halter. So one associate of Jay's wrote in 1783. John Jay's maxim that those who own the country ought to govern it, that is in fact the principle on which the Republic was founded and maintained. And in its very nature, capitalist democracy cannot stray very far from this pattern. At home, that means that politics should reduce, in effect, to interactions among groups of investors who compete for control of the state. This conception is what political scientist Thomas Ferguson calls the investment theory of politics, and he argues, I think very plausibly, that it explains a large part of U.S. political history. For our dependencies, the same basic principle entails that democracy is achieved when the society is under the control of local oligarchies, business-based elements linked to U.S. investors, the military under our control, and professionals who can be trusted to follow orders and serve the interests of U.S. power and privilege. If there's any popular challenge to the rule of these elements, then we are entitled to resort to violence to restore democracy. I use here the term that's conventionally employed by the media in reference to the Reagan Doctrine in Nicaragua, where we are restoring democracy. In reference to the Third World, the media contrast the Democrats with the Communists. The Democrats are those who serve the interests of U.S. power. The Communists are those afflicted with a disease that's called ultranationalism in top-secret U.S. government planning documents, such as those of the National Security Council going back for many decades. These documents explain very forthrightly that the threat to U.S. interests is nationalistic regimes that respond to domestic pressures for improvement of living standards and for social reform, regimes that have insufficient regard for the needs of U.S. investors. The media, then, are following the rules of the game when they contrast the fledgling democracies of Central America, which are under military and business control, with communist Nicaragua. And one can easily appreciate why the media suppressed the 1987 polls in El Salvador that reveal that a mere 10% of the population believe that there is a process of democracy and freedom in the country at present. The point is that the benighted Salvadorans doubtless fail to comprehend the American concept of democracy. In accordance with these conceptions, There's no infringement on democracy if a few corporations control the information system. In fact, that is the essence of democracy. In the annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science, a prestigious U.S. journal, the leading figure of the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, explained back in the 1940s that the very essence of the democratic process is the freedom to persuade and suggest, what he calls the engineering of consent. He goes on to say, a leader frequently cannot wait for the people to arrive at even general understanding. Democratic leaders must play their part in engineering consent to socially constructive goals and values. They must apply scientific principles and tried practices to the task of getting people to support ideas and programs. He doesn't say this, but it's understood that business will judge what is socially constructive, and business will engineer consent through the media and implement policy through the state authorities. If the freedom to persuade happens to be concentrated in a few hands, as it obviously is, we must recognize that that's the nature of a free society. Similar ideas are standard across the political spectrum. The dean of U.S. journalists, Walter Lippmann, observed that what he called the manufacture of consent has become, quote, a self-conscious art and a regular organ of popular government. He felt that this was quite appropriate, because, in his words, the common interests very largely elude public opinion entirely and can be managed only by a specialized class whose personal interests reach beyond the locality. Lippmann was writing shortly after World War I. At that time, the liberal intellectual community was much impressed with their success in serving as, quote, the faithful and helpful interpreters of what seems to be one of the greatest enterprises ever undertaken by an American president. The enterprise was Woodrow Wilson's interpretation of his electoral mandate for peace without victory as the occasion for pursuing victory without peace. In this, he was assisted by the liberal intellectuals, who later praised themselves in their words for having imposed their will upon a reluctant or indifferent majority. 15 years later, in 1933, a political scientist, Harold Lasswell, explained in an article in the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences that we should not succumb to what he called democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests. They are not. The best judges are the elites, who must therefore be ensured the means to impose their will for the common good. When social arrangements deny them the required force to compel obedience, it's necessary to turn to what Lasswell called a whole new technique of control, largely through propaganda, because of the ignorance and superstition of the masses. In the same years, the much-respected moralist Reinhold Niebuhr argued that rationality belongs to the cool observers, while the proletarian follows not reason but faith, based upon a crucial element of necessary illusion. Without such illusion, Niebuhr held, the ordinary person will descend to inertia. Niebuhr was then in his Marxist phase, and he urged that those whom he addressed, that is, the cool observers, recognize the stupidity of the average man and provide the emotionally potent oversimplifications that are required to keep the proletarian on course to create a new society. These basic conceptions underwent very little change as Niebuhr became what Richard Rovere called the official establishment theologian, offering counsel to those who face the responsibilities of power. After World War II, as the ignorant public reverted to their slothful pacifism, at a time when elites understood that we must mobilize for renewed global conflict, historian Thomas Bailey wrote that, quote, because the masses are notoriously short-sighted and generally cannot see danger until it is at their throats, our statesmen are forced to deceive them into an awareness of their own long-run interests. Deception of the people may become increasingly necessary unless we are willing to give our leaders in Washington a freer hand. Moving to another point on the political spectrum, the conservative contempt for democracy is succinctly articulated by Sir Lewis Namir, who writes that, quote, there is no free will in the thinking and action of the masses. any more than in the revolution of the planets, in the migration of birds, and in the plunging of hordes of lemmings into the sea. Only disaster could ensue, therefore, if the masses are permitted to enter the arena of decision-making in a meaningful way. Across the political spectrum, the fact that the voice of the people is heard in democratic societies is considered a problem to be overcome. The problem must be overcome by ensuring somehow that the public voice speaks the right words. The general conception is that leaders control us, not that we control them. If the population is out of control and propaganda doesn't work, then the state is forced underground to clandestine operations and secret wars. The scale of covert operations is often quite a good measure of popular dissidence. That was dramatically the case during the Reagan period. Among this group of self-styled conservatives, the commitment to untrammeled executive power and the contempt for democracy reached unusual heights. Accordingly, so did the resort to propaganda campaigns, targeting the media and the general population. One example was the establishment of the State Department Office of Latin American Public Diplomacy, which conducted such projects as Operation Truth. That was described by one high government official as a huge psychological operation of the kind the military conducts to influence a population in denied or enemy territory. The terms express lucidly the attitude towards the errant public, enemy territory that must be conquered and subdued. Sometimes the domestic enemy is hard to subdue. That was happening by the late 1960s. Lyndon Johnson was never able to declare a national mobilization to fight the Vietnam War efficiently in the manner of World War II, which turned out to be highly beneficial to the U.S. economy under the national mobilization. Johnson, in contrast, was forced to fight what was called a guns and butter war with deficit financing, and he was forced to do that in order to prevent an explosion in enemy territory at home. That was very harmful to the American economy. And after the Tet Offensive, business elites generally concluded that the enterprise should be liquidated as too costly. It was public dissidence and protest that made it too costly. That's a fact that should be remembered by people who hope to influence government policy in elite-run democracies. When the Reaganites came into office, they pretty clearly intended to undertake direct military intervention in Central America in the Kennedy-Johnson style. They assumed that the domestic enemy had been tamed. That was the import of the February 1981 White Paper. To their very great surprise, however, large-scale protest arose all through the country. The administration, at that point, turned to illegal clandestine operations. They were driven underground by the domestic enemy. This, in fact, is the real meaning of the Iran-Contra affair. In the dependencies, we may turn to violence to restore democracy. At home, more subtle means are required. The manufacture of consent, deceiving the stupid masses with necessary illusions, covert operations, while the media and Congress pretend not to see until it all becomes too obvious to be suppressed. At that point, we shift to the phase of damage control to ensure that public attention is diverted to overzealous patriots or personality defects of leaders who have strayed from our noble commitments. The task of the free press in such circumstances is to take the proceedings seriously and to describe them as a tribute to the soundness of our self-correcting institutions. In tomorrow's lecture, I want to concentrate on the project of containing the enemy, where in fact there are two enemies that have to be contained. One is the foreign enemy. The second are the residents of enemy territory at home, the domestic population.